Recognize this voice?
That's the 14th of 14 in a row. You know how many minutes of solid music we just had? 48 and a half. Uninterrupted minutes of music in 1 hour. 70 degrees now. The skies are cloudy.
That is Bachelor Jeff Christie, the morning drive time DJ on WIXZ-FM in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, back in the early 1970s. Now, Bachelor Jeff goes by a different name, and he happens to host the most popular radio show in America.
What a day, ladies and gentlemen. Greetings. Great to have you with us. I am Rush Limbaugh, and this is the one and only Excellence in Broadcasting Network, and we've got broadcast excellence for the next 3 hours.
Rush Limbaugh, of course, is much loved. He's also much hated, but no matter what you think of him, it is hard to deny that he is a tremendous influence, and our next guest got some rare access to Limbaugh for his new book, Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One. Zev Chaffetz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You write a book about the personal side of Rush Limbaugh. Are your liberal friends still inviting you over for cocktails these days?
Yeah, they invite me over, and they're curious about Rush. Most of them don't listen and have never listened to him. And so they're interested, I think, sometimes to know what it is he actually says and how it is that he manages to keep such an incredibly large audience.
And I think a lot of people out there do wonder that. What is this guy's appeal? And what would you say to them? I mean, you get into this in the book, but what would you tell people who just don't get it?
Well, you know, Martin Luther King once said, and I hate to be one of these guys who quotes Martin Luther King, but he said,
go right ahead,
that 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday is the most segregated hour in America. And I would say that between noon and 3, Monday through Friday, when the Limbaugh show is on, is the most politically segregated hours in America. The country is really divided into people who listen to Limbaugh or who don't listen to Limbaugh.
And so who's listening in that window?
Well, it's as male as Oprah's audience is female.
Interesting.
It is at least as well educated as any mainstream publication or show, and older, conservative, Republican people, mostly in the heartland, although Limbaugh is the most popular show in most of the coastal cities, including New York.
You know, it's not a secret. I think a lot of people would be surprised about one thing that you tell us in the book, and that's, you know, here we have one of the most heard voices in America, but Rush Limbaugh is actually almost deaf.
No, he's stone deaf. He can't hear a thing. And he went deaf on the radio. I mean, it was a process of some time, but he gradually went deaf. In the last few months of his deafness, he was broadcasting every day. And then he went and got a cochlear implant.
But it's an implant that lets him hear something, some voices?
Yes. If you sit with him in a quiet room, face to face, you can talk with him easily. He almost never talks on the phone. I went out with him one night with him and his girlfriend, now his fiance, and we sat at a quiet table, but he couldn't hear a thing.
You also use the word charming to describe Rush Limbaugh, and I can hear more liberal listeners cringing right now. How do you convince them that that's even possible?
Well, you know, first of all, he's different from his on-air persona. He's much less bombastic. He's much less outspoken. In the book, I compare him a little bit to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was, in public, a very bombastic guy. And in private, people say that he was soft-spoken and that his public persona was just a ramping up of his real personality, and that he did the public persona to gather a crowd. And I think that that's very true of Limbaugh also. The other comparison I make between Limbaugh and Muhammad Ali is that they both are natural-born fighters, and they love to take on big opponents. Limbaugh's favorite fights have been with presidents of the United States or heads of the Democratic Party. These are his Joe Frazier's and his George Foreman's.
To keep the boxing analogy going, what would your guidance be to someone who comes to you and says, you know what, I listened to Rush Limbaugh for, you know, advice on how to develop my political opinions? I mean, if a lot of what he's doing is for pure politics, I mean, would you say that that's okay? Or would you advise someone to be like, you know what, listen to him for entertainment, but find some policymakers, find some others to sort of, you know, help mold your political views?
Well, Limbaugh is both a political figure and an intellectual figure. His view of the world is a view which has educated many millions of Americans. What view is that? The easiest way to put it is to say that it's Reaganism. Limbaugh believes in smaller government. He believes in less government. He believes in the Republican Party is the instrument of that. He's a spokesman for corporate America. He's a hawk abroad. He believes in American exceptionalism. He's less of a social conservative. He's certainly not a member of the Christian right. But I think that it's very important for a democracy to have very clear enunciations on both ends of the spectrum of these kinds of policy opinions.
You argued in a recent New York Times piece that Republican success in 2010 can be boiled down to two words, Rush Limbaugh. And I guess my question is what, if any, risk there is for Republicans following one man, one voice so closely if this is someone who never has to stand for election?
Well, they have to stand for election on Limbaugh's principles.
Republican candidates do.
The Republican candidates do, if they choose to. And then they'll be tested. Now, Limbaugh has a mantra: real conservatism wins every time it's tried. By real conservative, he means Reaganite conservatism. Whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But it looks to me like it's going to be tested in 2010. And if the Republican Party, having moved to the Limbaugh-Reagan right, scores a big victory, I think that's going to be interpreted in the Republican Party as a vindication of Limbaugh's belief.
Zev Chaffetz is the author of the new book, Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One. Thanks so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
If you want to read an excerpt of Rush Limbaugh, An Army of One, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Green. And I'm Renee Montaigne. Emily Dickinson lived a reclusive life at her family's home in Amherst, Massachusetts. She rarely went into society, though she did spend a lot of time outdoors. She loved nature and gardening. NPR's Lynn Neary toured an exhibition at the New York Botanical Garden to discover a side of the poet that's little known.
I was always attached to mud, Emily Dickinson once wrote. Dickinson had a sophisticated understanding of plants and flowers, which is reflected in her poetry. Gregory Long, the president and CEO of the New York Botanical Garden, says she used to tuck little poems into bouquets of flowers, which she gave to her neighbors.
The people of Amherst, who were the friends of Emily Dickinson and her family, often received these poems, these short poems with presents of flowers or food. And they knew her as a poet because of these, because nothing was really published in her life, or very, very little was published. So they found these poems, of course, very eccentric. But they loved having the flowers.
Well, I was surprised to read that she was better known as a gardener, actually, in her lifetime than as a poet.
She was very respected by her neighbors and the people of Amherst as a good gardener. And she knew a great deal about plants, and she grew them very well. And what we found is that her poems are not sentimental valentines to flowers. They're serious poems, but they're tied to her great passion for plants and nature. So we decided, well, we should introduce everybody to Emily Dickinson, not only as a poet, but as a gardener.
Maybe we can take a little walk along this poetry walk here, and you can explain to me why some of the poems are placed where they are.
On the path, more than 30 poems are displayed on boards near some of the plants and trees and flowers that inspired them. The walk begins near a delicate rose bush. Jennifer Rothman, who helped design the poetry walk, reads the first poem, which Dickinson wrote in memory of a young child.
She sped as petals of a rose, offended by the wind, a frail aristocrat of time, indemnity to find, leaving on nature a default, as cricket or as bee, but Andes in the bosoms where she had begun to lie.
So this is a poem about a child who died.
When she was just 2 years old. And this poem talks about a rose being so so fragile, and that this little girl was a frail aristocrat of her time. She left on nature this huge void.
How hard was it to decide where to place the poems in the garden?
Well, it started by going through all of her poems and finding first the ones that had to do with flowers or plants and narrowing it down to that group. And so then we chose poems that would reflect the flowers that would be in bloom or the landscape. And so there's a poem not too far from here called Four Trees on a Solitary Acre. And you'll see there's four beautiful trees in front of a large lawn of grass, and it's a perfect poem for that setting.
Inside the glass-domed conservatory is a recreation of Dickinson's own garden. Todd Forrest, who designed this garden, says it is filled with the types of flowers Dickinson might have planted around her family's home. Foxglove, daffodils, zinnias, and hydrangeas, all blooming at the same time in this hothouse atmosphere, overflow the garden beds. There's even a small orchard.
So within the orchard, we have sort of a meadowy feeling design that has some of the flowers that might have been growing either naturally or through planting in the fields and meadows around her home, including dandelions. Now this, I know for a fact, is the first time we ever have grown dandelions for a flower show. But dandelions were very important to her. In fact, she referred to herself more as a dandelion. She felt more comfortable and more natural in the fields with the dandelions than she would in the drawing rooms with the fancy folks around Amherst.
Did it hurt you just a little bit to plant a dandelion?
You raise an eyebrow.
We have to prevent the gardeners from pulling it. You see this lovely stanza about the orchard?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a dome.
That's great. Gardening was her religion.
Yes, in addition to everything else.
Do you think she really did the digging and the weeding herself?
Absolutely. Yeah? Absolutely. She tramped through the woods her entire life. I have no doubt that she was out there, you know, deadheading, dividing. Any gardener is only happy when you're out in the garden pulling a weed or two, including dandelions.
A path through the garden leads to a facade that represents Dickinson's family home. And just inside, there's a small replica of her bedroom.
She wrote most of her poetry sitting at a small desk, a very small and simple desk, in her bedroom. As we walk over here, we would look out the window across a woodland to her brother Austin's house, that Italianate house off in the distance. And she would go out to visit her brother and sister-in-law next door, come back, and then light a lamp in the window to let them know she had returned. And we found that our visitors like to stop and look out the window, and it makes them slow down and look at the garden very much as Emily might have.
The path between the two homes, the wooded path, she used to say, was just wide enough for two who love.
And this was sort of like her whole world between these two houses.
That's
and
right,
the garden.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was really her world.
Yes. She used to bring her niece Maddie to her room, and she would close the door and lock it and say, "This is freedom." And so she really felt that when she was in her room and she was looking out along the wooded path between her family homes, that she was free.
The exhibition concludes in the Botanical Gardens Library, where objects from Emily Dickinson's life are on display, including the white cotton dress she wore even while gardening. She always kept a poem she was working on in the pocket of the dress. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
You can see photos of the flower show at the New York Botanical Garden and that white cotton dress at NPR.org.
Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley never shies away from new terrain in her work. Among other topics, she's written about racehorses and dentistry, Dickens and dairy farms. Her latest novel, called Private Life, scrutinizes marital disappointments against the backdrop of historical tragedies. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The heroine of Jane Smiley's latest novel, Private Life, lives with her husband at the Naval Shipyard on Mare Island, north of San Francisco. There, while in bed one evening in 1906, she feels the earth move, and it has nothing to do with her husband. A lamp falls off the bedside table, just minor damage. But over on the mainland, all hell breaks loose as San Francisco collapses in the great earthquake and fire that follows. Margaret Mayfield Early is a quiet woman who keeps her own counsel, a watcher rather than an actor in history's great dramas. The years roll on and other events transpire. Sailors leave Mare Island for service in World Wars I and II. The Spanish flu epidemic and the Great Depression hit. Margaret lives at a remove through them all. until one day she quietly realizes that the man she spent most of her life married to is, at best, a fool. This time, the epicenter of the earthquake is in her brain. Private Life is a powerful turn-of-the-last-century American novel in both chronology and style. It spans the decades from Margaret's childhood in Missouri after the Civil War up to the early years of World War II. Smiley has tried her hand at historical novels before, as well as an academic farce and even a suspense tale. But at bottom, she's always been a master chronicler of the climate changes in relationships. I think especially of her great-great novella, The Age of Grief. Here, her compelling story about a long marriage has an Edith Wharton, Henry James feel of sinister delicacy about it. Margaret is afflicted by the same strain of paralysis that defines Newland Archer in Wharton's Age of Innocence. In the opening section of the novel, shrewd older women around Margaret conspire to orchestrate her marriage at the desperately ripe old age of 27 to Captain Andrew Jackson Jefferson Early, a Navy astronomer in his 30s and the most famous man that their little Midwestern town has ever produced. Describing their courtship, Smiley's deadpan, omniscient narrator says that Margaret felt pleasing dread at Captain Early's approach and that their wedding was quickly accomplished. By the time Margaret understands both the betrayal she's been subjected to and the true character of her husband, her feeble spirit of defiance has all but calcified. Margaret and Andrew move to Mare Island immediately after the wedding because he's put in charge of the observatory there. Andrew has made a tentative reputation for himself with his theories about double stars. Soon he's filling up their small house with dusty piles of scientific journals, churning out boulder-sized books with titles like The Universe Explained, and engaging in one-sided debates with his nemesis, Albert Einstein. Reflecting on one of his manuscripts, which of course she's been expected to type, Margaret thinks, what Andrew's theory was, precisely, she could not herself have said, though she partially understood the second half of the second volume, which was that if they could harness the power of the ether, they would be as gods. Having been left to think and think and think, Andrew had made up his mind that thinking was everything. Over the decades, Margaret, like a lot of women, carves out a small, separate life for herself without explicitly recognizing this as a marital survival strategy. She befriends a Russian emigre and a Nellie Bly-type female journalist and a Japanese-American family. Our narrator tells us that Margaret, at 60, had gotten into the habit of congratulating herself for being balanced. But, she saw, she was balanced on a very narrow perch. Private Life is a wistful and beautifully observed novel about nice girls finishing last. Margaret always listened to her practical mother, who opined that romance was always the first act of a tragedy. But as Smiley makes clear, relationships that don't have their roots in passion are capable of their own peculiar devastations of spirit.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Private Life by Jane Smiley. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.